Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, where you hear about the business of the casino entertainment industry from the people who make it happen. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of GGB, and this week we feature an interview with Lyle Berman, the chairman and CEO of Lakes Entertainment, on the recently announced purchase of his company by Nevada's Golden Gaming. Lyle Berman is a legend in the casino industry. His first taste of gaming came as a poker player, where he gleaned bits and pieces of information about casinos. When an opportunity was presented to get in on the ground floor of tribal government gaming, he jumped at it, and the rest is history. Berman's Grand Casinos became the largest operator of tribal casinos in Minnesota and later in other states. In Mississippi, Grand Casinos had commercial gaming properties in Gulfport, Biloxi, and Tunica. A few years after Berman sold his company to then Bally Entertainment, now Caesars, he launched Lakes Entertainment, another tribal gaming operator that he recently sold to Golden Gaming in Las Vegas. He spoke with me at his building in Vegas in March. Lyle Berman, thanks for joining us on the GGB podcast. I've wanted to sit down with you for quite some time, and I'm glad we found some time here in Las Vegas.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
You know, you made the news last week. You've made a lot of deals in your life, you know, some big, some small. Where does this recent merger between Lakes Entertainment and Golden Gaming, where does that fall?
Well, this really falls as a very large enterprise, and we're really excited about it. Mm-hmm. It's really transforming Lakes. Lakes was a company that specialized in Native American gaming.
Right.
However, it was formed in 1999, and over the years, we developed a number of Native American gaming, but as of a couple of years ago, we had been bought out of our last contract, mm-hmm. so we were sitting with this public company with, quite frankly, a lot of cash,
right.
which is a nice thing to have,
right.
but really no major business. We did own a smaller casino,
mm-hmm.
a very profitable casino in Maryland, but that was it.
Right.
And we spent a year and a half to 2 years looking for new opportunities, and believe me, it takes more time to look sometimes for new things than it is to run them.
Mm-hmm.
And we got very close to a couple of things, but for whatever reason, they didn't work out. And finally, we were introduced to Golden Gaming from our investment banking advisor, mm-hmm. Macquarie. And things clicked right away. We liked the business. We were a perfect fit with mm-hmm. each other. Quite frankly, they needed additional equity in their business.
Right.
But they have a very good expansion opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And it just worked real well. Our existing business, we're going to be moving to Las Vegas.
Okay.
The company, it'll be primarily run by Golden Gaming
mm-hmm.
once we merge. I'm staying on as a consultant to the company. I like to stress, I'm not retiring, active consultant, but a consultant nonetheless.
Okay.
And it's a very important step in Lake's evolvement.
Right. So are you going to be on the board of directors or just a consultant?
Oh, no. I'm definitely going to be. The board of directors is designed to be three people from Lakes,
okay.
three people from Golden Gaming, and then one independent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is your role going to be? Again, looking for opportunities for expansion?
I think I'll probably be involved primarily in looking and evaluating new opportunities
mm-hmm.
as they come along.
Right.
I don't think, I will not be involved in what we call day-to-day operations.
Sure.
But it'll be primarily new ideas for, I like to stress, with all their food operations. I want to be chairman of the food committee at least, or at least have it be on the food committee. I have strong feelings on certain products.
Mm-hmm,
and
sure.
But it'll be primarily with new opportunities.
Okay. Well, they've got a very strong business here in Las Vegas with the PT pub chains here, Gold, and several other brands. So that's something that you really haven't been involved in, something like that, in the past.
No, except that we've been involved in the restaurant industry
right, of course.
Know the restaurant industry.
Yeah.
And I think one of the ways that the company could expand would be into just the restaurant business. They have great expertise. I had lunch yesterday with Blake at Sierra Gold, and I thought the food was fabulous. I mean, I think that concept without slot machines would work all over the country.
Yeah.
So, and he agrees that there could be some major opportunities to expand in the restaurant industry without gaming as a component.
Sure. Yeah, no question. Well, you know, I want to go back to the beginning, really. You're recognized as a visionary in the industry because of the way you helped develop tribal government gaming. When did it occur to you that this was going to be a real important part of the gaming industry as a whole?
Well, I think it evolved. Certainly, we got into it a little. I got into it a little bit by accident. Mm-hmm. Two friends of mine had developed, had obtained a contract with one tribe in Minnesota to open up two casinos.
Right.
Back in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And I like to say, when they came to me looking for financing and help, that I knew the power of a slot machine.
Right.
They knew the power of my money, mm-hmm. and we formed a joint venture. But in those days, it was in the early 90s. It was to open a couple casinos and see how it did. But as soon as we opened them, we realized how popular they were,
right.
and what opportunities there would be throughout games. So I'd say probably by 92, 93 is when mm-hmm. we really realized there was a major opportunity in Native American gaming for
right.
a company like ours that not mm-hmm. only could bring money to the table, which the Indians, Native Americans definitely needed,
sure.
but also we brought the expertise.
Right.
And those two things helped a great deal.
Sure. I think that's when we first met. I traveled to Minnesota, I think in 92 or 93, and did a little tour of uh-huh. all the tribal casinos up there. Went to the Grand Casino in Mille Lacs and the one in Hinckley. And, I was amazed at the operations and how busy they were up there. There were a couple of little differences between Las Vegas, obviously, and the tribes. You had to use video machines there, if I'm not mistaken.
And still to this day,
right.
we have legislators who tell you there are no slot machines in Minnesota.
That's right.
They're video lottery terminals.
Exactly, right. And I think in those days, there were some table games in those days, right?
When it first opened, no, but yeah. very early on, they got blackjack.
Right, right. In fact,
and to this day, in Minnesota, they're only allowed... I think card table games. There's
right.
no craps.
Right.
There's video craps and
sure.
video roulette.
Right.
But there's no craps and no roulette
right.
live games.
Right. Now you were working with the Mille Lacs tribes, and were you dealing with their legendary leader at the time, Marge Anderson?
Oh, absolutely. Oh. Marge and I became very good friends.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was an amazing woman, and the way gaming transformed that tribe and certainly all the others in the state was pretty impressive.
Absolutely, and one of the things that Marge always wanted was she didn't want to necessarily support Native Americans with per capita distributions.
Right.
She wanted to make the reservation a better place for everybody to live if mm-hmm. they chose to.
Right, right. Now, you were a poker player long before you got officially involved in the industry. Was that how you got drawn into the industry, by playing poker?
Well, yes, I think so. I'd like to say I started playing poker in the early 80s. And played quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So when my two friends of mine, partners, came to me with the idea of Native American gaming, in those days Minnesota tribes had the right to do the video slot
right.
machines, I'd like to say I knew the power of a slot machine.
Mm-hmm.
I'd become friends with Bobby Baldwin,
right.
with Jack Binion, and Bob Stupak,
mm-hmm.
and thought it would be a very good endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
I know what sold me, if there is a day of reckoning that sold me for Native American, there was a smaller casino west of Minneapolis. The name escapes me, but
Firefly Creek.
What?
I love Firefly Creek. I remember
no,
going there.
No,
that was a little tiny one.
This was west.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a couple hour drive west of mm-hmm. Minneapolis. It was managed by some local businessmen.
Mm-hmm.
It was on July 4th. It was the most gorgeous day you could imagine in Minneapolis. It was 82 degrees. And these were more like, I call them Quonset huts almost.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we walk into the casino, it's smoky, it's horrible, and it's packed.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know what? If on July 4th these machines are going to be packed in this environment,
right.
just think what's going to happen when it's 10 below zero
yeah, exactly, right.
in northern Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And that literally was my eye-opener. If this can work on this day,
mm-hmm.
in this environment, think what it could work in a first-class environment.
Yeah.
And I believe we were the first company to really develop a first-class Native American casino in Grand Casino Hinckley that really would compete with a Vegas casino. And, of course, since then, we've built even bigger and better
yeah,
ones.
Sure,
a
course.
Number of our casinos would stand tall on the strip. We have to say the one in Michigan, the Four Winds Casino,
mm-hmm.
If it were in Vegas Strip, it would have the second largest capacity of any casino on the Strip,
right? Right.
Except MGM,
mm-hmm.
assuming Wynn is two and Palazzo
right.
and Sands are two. or Venetian are two. Mm-hmm. It was a lot. So we developed big first class facilities. We also were visionaries down on the Gulf Coast.
Right, and that's where I want to go next. You know, Mississippi was one of the early entrants into riverboat gambling. But the one difference that they had, you know, I've heard this story many times. Right before they put the bill in, they took out Musk Cruise, so they became barge casinos, and that made all the difference.
Well, they did become barge casinos until we came along. What they were was boats tied to a pier.
Right.
And yeah. I'll give you my day of reckoning there. We go down to Cincinnati, and we're on the river, and we go to have lunch in a big barge on the river in Cincinnati, right. An entertainment barge. And we go to TGI Fridays, and actually the chandelier actually swung a little bit. But we were in just one small corner of this barge. Mm-hmm. And it said, wait a second, if you can do this on a barge, you can put a casino on a barge. And there was nothing that said this, unlike Illinois, where the boat had to have motors and crews, even though it didn't, it just had it float.
Right.
And we realized you can build anything to float. I mean, I could build the Empire State Building to float if I build a big enough barge.
Sure.
And that's when we commissioned, and we did really set the standard in all three, Tunica, mm-hmm. Biloxi, and Gulfport. We built these huge casinos on barges, and barges were custom made for us that floated. Mm-hmm. And when you think of Tunica, I mean, they were 630 feet long, three stories high, you know, 50 feet wide. And I remember in Gulfport, we built it we went round the clock, we built it in 156 days.
Right.
Wow. Today they talk about building big casinos, 2-year development, 3-year development. Now, we didn't build any hotels in those days.
Sure.
But
that was a huge barge, though. Yeah. I mean,
so those, I guess, would be my two days of reckoning. One is in the casino in Minnesota on July 4th, and the other was in this barge in Cincinnati.
Right. But the Mississippi casinos were a huge hit right from the start. I mean,
yes, they were. We were a huge hit. We set the standard. Mm-hmm. Today, of course, now they're land-based. Right. And that's another thing I predicted. The law that made them first cruise and then float.
Right.
I said it the day we built it. Mm-hmm. The first hurricane that comes here and wipes this out, there'll be land.
Right.
What's interesting is when we built them, they were designed so that they had to be designed so you could float them into the back bay if a hurricane. The problem is that when hurricanes are out on the Gulf, you don't know where they're going to go.
Right.
It's beautiful. When they're 200 miles out, it's gorgeous on the Gulf Coast. Mm-hmm. Yet by the time you know it's going to hit, you can't move it.
Yeah.
So the whole concept of having it, designing it so it could float away, was hocus pocus.
Right,
it could never do it, and nobody ever floated them away.
No, except for the hurricane.
We had in Biloxi our entire casino, remember, 630 feet long.
Right.
Three stories high, the hurricane of Katrina wave came up, broke it off its moorings, took the entire casino and moved it to the other side of Highway 10.
Right.
And structurally it was demolished, but it was this big building sitting on the other side of 10. Now, how that force, you just can't imagine.
I mean, I remember the moorings you had them tied to, and they went up, what, 30, 40
feet?
And they were 8 feet
wide. Yeah, with big cylinders, because they went up and floated up and down.
So did it float them off of those, or did it break them off?
What?
Did it float them over them? You know, the rim?
I couldn't tell you that.
It just looked, I couldn't believe
it. It did the same in Gulfport, not the main casino, but we had an additional barge, which was an entertainment barge with nightclubs and restaurants. That was broken loose, floated up, and that also ended up on the other side of town.
Yeah, pretty amazing force there. That's incredible, and it still hasn't recovered to this day, unfortunately.
Right.
And then while you were still developing, still running Grand Casinos, you talked to your friend Bob Stupak, who you just mentioned here, was this before or after he passed away that you took over the Stratosphere?
Oh, no, that was way before.
Okay.
Yeah, remember when they had the fire?
Right.
Is when he got in trouble.
Right.
And I'd often talk to him about let's get involved. Mm-hmm. And when he got in trouble, we came in and became partners with Bob. And at one point, it was an interesting story. Grand Casino, we wanted to buy him out and just make it part of Graham.
Right.
And we offered him 50 or 60 million for his shares. He said, don't be ridiculous, it'll be worth 200 million.
Right.
And that's when we took it public, and he was a public shareholder. Right. And of course, it didn't work out so well.
Right, no.
For him or us.
For him or us, you're right, exactly. It seems to be doing pretty well now, though, so far.
Yeah, Carl Icahn's done a nice job. I know, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, I went there to see it, and I wanted not to like what he did.
Right.
And I thought he did a real good job on some of the remodels and some of the changes, and I was very impressed. Yeah. I haven't been there for a while, but it was very impressive.
Yeah, he's definitely done a good job marketing it as well.
Yes.
You built a formidable team, and I don't want to mention anybody except probably for Tom Brosig, but starting from him on down, you had some really impressive people who today play a big role in the industry. How important was that team that you built there?
Well, that was 100%.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it any of it on my own. I mean, at one point, we had a fantastic team at Grand Casino. We were managing 8 major large casinos, of course, from our corporate offices, and I don't think there was any kind of meaningful gaming company that we didn't have somebody who had worked there.
Right, sure.
So we not only had people in the industry, but we had the sum total knowledge of the industry. And we did a very good job. We set a lot of new precedents. We were one of the first that developed fantastic buffets on the Gulf Coast in our casinos and the Native American casinos. We were the first ones who developed the self-service pop machines in all of the casinos that is standard today.
Right, yeah.
We did that.
Yep, I remember that, yeah.
We were actually the very first casino in America that had 100% ticket-in, ticket-out machines. Mm-hmm. You know, cash-in, ticket-out. They didn't take coin.
Right.
And I remember one time after we opened it, Bobby Baldwin came to me and he said, you know, Steve Wynn asked me to ask you, you know, what kind of research, what did you guys do to make that decision? Mm-hmm. And I looked at Bobby and I said, it was just common sense.
Right.
I said, we didn't do one market study. We didn't do anything. We just said, this has got to work, and it did.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you were also one of the first companies to bring in celebrity chefs. I remember when Grand Casino and Biloxi opened, you had a couple of celebrity chefs there.
We did that more with Rainforest Cafe, with celebrity chefs, which we developed. But yeah, we did that too.
Yes. So a lot of the innovations that came in, certainly through the regional casinos, Grand Casinos had a big role in
it. Yeah, we not just copied from Vegas, but we did things that ultimately went back to Vegas.
Right.
Yes.
So I guess you studied your market whenever you went in there to figure out what the people in that market would like.
Too bad maybe we should have patented some of our ideas.
That's true, because everybody has copied them for sure. Now, after you made Grand Casinos a pretty formidable company, you sold out to Park Place Entertainment, of course now Caesars. Tell us how that came about.
Well, I don't remember exactly, but they came to us and ultimately the end result is they want us out, but it was a merger.
Mm-hmm.
And we merged, they wanted to expand into the Mississippi.
Right.
So they wanted our three owned casinos in Mississippi, and Hilton wanted to split up into two businesses. They wanted to keep hotels and then casinos separate.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made sense. They didn't want to be in Native American business. So that's why when we did the merger at the end of 1998, we formed Lakes and kept three things. We kept cash.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We kept our Native American contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And we owned a bunch of land. We owned about 15 acres of land around Polo Towers.
Right.
And we kept that. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we've sold that out. But those were the three assets that we kept out of the merger.
Okay.
And we merged, and I joined the board, the board with Arthur Goldberg.
Right.
Again, though, I was I was a passive consultant.
Mm-hmm.
I had a job description that said, I'll do whatever he asks.
Right.
And I think in the 2-year contract, he never asked, and I never did.
Yeah.
Other than the board.
Now, by that time, your contract with the Mille Lacs Tribe in Minnesota had lapsed, and they were running it themselves.
That one, it lapsed. We had two. We had the two in Mississippi, the Tunica Biloxi of Oils contract,
right.
And we had the one, near Lake Charles.
Right. Now, Lynx, continued. You did, as you mentioned, the Four Winds, which is the
When we did the merger, our mission was to stay in Native American gaming. Mm-hmm. We went out and got what we thought were the three best, maybe were the three best opportunities at the mm-hmm. time, which was one in Sacramento, one in Michigan, and one in San Diego.
Right.
The problem was in our first years, we never had all of the lawsuits that delayed everything.
Right.
And those three casinos, one still, we signed the contracts in 1999. Mm-hmm. Michigan opened 7 years or 8 years right. later. I think the one in Sacramento opened 10 years later due to lawsuits.
Right.
And this one in San Diego is still not open, although mm-hmm. we have ceased not being a part of that.
Right.
And Penn Gaming has taken over the development.
Right,
of
that's
that.
A Jamul tribe.
Hamul,
right, okay.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of, you mentioned Caesars didn't want to be in the Native American business. It's not easy to deal with tribes. It's a whole different kind of ballgame than we're dealing with.
Yeah,
investors.
It's a whole different ballgame, and it's kind of hard from a big corporate standpoint. Mm-hmm. Now, it's Harris. Harris did done a fairly good job mm-hmm. of managing it, but in general, big corporations don't do very well.
Right.
They're too structured. They're not flexible.
Right.
Tribes are very, they want to meet the main man. They
sure.
want to
right.
deal. So yeah,
you have to have a relationship
yes.
with the tribal
yeah.
leaders.
Yeah.
But then tribal leaders can change also.
They always change.
Always
they always change, and you have to deal with them. I like to tell a story. Some good friends of mine mm-hmm. copied our business, and they developed, actually not a casino, but a big bingo hall down in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And when the tribal council changed, they went to meet the new council. And the first item on the agenda was, should we honor the old contract?
Yeah,
but we had good relationship with tribe. We had some disagreements from
sure.
time to time, mm-hmm. but never anything that got into court or anything like that.
Yeah. So. And again, it's that personal relationship.
But it was. Well, my philosophy, and I did this every time, when we signed the contract,
mm-hmm.
the first thing I did in front of the council was rip up the contract in front of them and said, you know what, we're partners now, you're the boss, we're not going to go back to our contract, we're going to do, what you want,
right.
unless you want to change the economics.
Right, of course.
Then we'll go back to
right,
the
right.
contract.
Okay.
But other than that, we recognize that we're working for you,
right?
And we're partners, but that philosophy worked pretty good.
And again, it's more of a development of a culture rather than just providing shareholders value. I mean, you have to provide them something more than just money. You have to show the way where tribal members can become executives and things of that nature.
Oh, that was part of our contract mm-hmm. with them. Was mission was to develop. It wasn't to develop the council to help manage a casino,
right.
but although they thought they could do that without us, but it was to develop management within the casino
mm-hmm.
to rise above the rank. And that did cause some friction because
right.
it's just like if you had a bunch of children working in your casino and you promoted them all, even though some of them weren't as qualified
right.
as their counterpart, there'd be some resentment.
Sure.
And there
right.
was that in Native American casinos
right.
as well.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the things that are happening today, and give me some of your feedback. There's so much competition today. Even in tribal casinos, commercial casinos, regional casinos, they all are under a lot of pressure right now because they've got to continue to make money, and there's competition popping up all around them. How do you view that?
Well, clearly, as you said, there's a lot of competition, and it does hurt the industry.
Mm-hmm.
It helps the states, of course,
correct.
When a new
sure.
state may hurt the state next door, but mm-hmm. the net result is the state that makes more money. But clearly, the margins are less. It's a tough business
mm-hmm.
today. A casino business, and this is true from long ago, where there's no competition, it's a slam dunk. I
right.
mean, it's anybody can run them.
Sure.
When it's competitive, it's really tough. And people don't realize it, but throughout, from 1980 on, there's always been 15-20% of the casinos in this town have been going through bankruptcy.
Right.
It's a competitive
sure.
industry.
Right.
When you put Native Americans up where there's no competition, they think they're geniuses,
mm-hmm.
and maybe we thought we were
right.
too, but it's easy. But look what happened to the two of the biggest and best casinos in America,
mm-hmm.
which were Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun.
Right.
Put up Pennsylvania put up, Maryland put up, Boston's coming on, and they're hurting big time. In addition, they made some internal mistakes.
Right.
I know Foxwoods expanded with MGM. I think they invested something like $1 billion and never got $1 return on it. I mean, all they did was increase their debt. And they aren't the only ones that have done that. And then, of course, there's been some Native American casinos that built, overbuilt, or built, there's one, there's a big one in New Mexico, I forget the name of it, that has gone through a number of problems because they just built too big a casino for the market. On the other hand, certain ones that have maintained their regional monopolies, like Mystic Lake in Minnesota, is one of the most profitable casinos in the United States. That one up in Green Bay.
Pottawatomie.
No competition. Huge success. But, and of course, whenever you put casinos where you have to bring people to, as opposed to Las Vegas has survived, yet they can't survive on the locals. They have to bring people from California, but eventually they became bring them from the world. And that's what they made them. But you take places like Atlantic City. They had to bring everybody there. Well, they didn't develop all the hotel rooms and they didn't develop the major tourist trade. It was a locals business out of New York and whatever. And when stuff came up around it, it failed. Today, if Texas, when, not if, when Texas legalizes casinos, they're going to put a whole big hurt on three states, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Louisiana. They surround, they're all Native American casinos. They all feed off the Texas population. And they're going to be hurting. So whenever now, today, whenever a new state legalizes, they're going to really hurt some other. And what we call, when we were looking at the casino in Wichita, we called it, there was no border risk. In Ohio, there was no border risk because all your, you were building a casino where the people were. And that's a much safer thing to do today than to build it where you have to bring them.
Now, is a big move these days that, you know, you have to have the non-gaming amenities. Is it possible to build a resort with a lot of non-gaming amenities and a little bit of gaming to make that a success? Or
depending on where it is, I think that's possible. Like, of course, one of the problems is the gaming revenue is so much more profitable than non-gaming revenue. You have a labor component, and in a slot machine, you don't have anything. And when you have non-gaming amenities, there's still a big cost to them. In Vegas, it's come to people expect to pay market rates here, unless they're big gamblers. But still, out in the provinces, I like to say, you still have to give a value. So you're still maybe. I mean, in Las Vegas, in your major casinos today, food and beverage is a big profit center. In our, for example, our casino in Maryland, we have four restaurants. Break even at best, and that's when if you don't count occupancy, you don't count rent or utilities, you just call direct costs. So we still have, in the outer markets, you still have to give a better value. One of the benefits is almost every state that legalizes gaming requires you to sell liquor. That's a nice thing. If your competitors have to sell it, we don't mind selling
it. And it's the same thing with smoking. If everybody else has it non-smoking, you deal with it.
Unless there's one near the border.
And then, like in Atlantic City, when they were trying to do non-smoking, Philadelphia continued to allow smoking. So that was very tough.
And of course, some of the people have had in Atlantic City in particular, I mean, they were major executives when when Philadelphia legal or Pennsylvania legalized, they said, "Oh yeah, that's gonna be slots in a barn." Well, that was so blindsided. I mean, look what Indian gaming had become. Indian gaming maybe started in a sprung structure, but the Indian gaming facilities throughout the country were first class facilities, and the Pennsylvania ones were being developed by big time guys. So, that was a little naive to think that that would be. Not that they could have done. Well, they could have. They could have put in much more infrastructure into Atlantic City and.
Now you, you spend a lot of time in casinos playing poker, and you see the way the casino floor has really evolved. Do you think that the gaming experience is changing, and that the casinos are being a little slow to change with it, and that's kind of why revenues have stayed flat, or
no? I think the casinos are changing. I mean, let's face it; just every year it becomes more automated, more automated, And I guess there's, I haven't seen them yet, there's a couple new tables in the MGM and the Mirage that are for fun now but are going to be gaming. There's some new stuff for bar top slots where you can play 3-4 games at the same time. And of course that, if you, you've probably seen the one in Palazzo, the Baccarat, where you can actually bet on four hands simultaneously.
Right.
Yet that's still somewhat live, but it all is getting more automated. But the end result is you can bet more faster and reduce labor, trying to make it more thing.
What do you make of this social gaming experiment where it's really booming? People are playing slots online and not getting anything returned, but they're buying these worthless chips. Have you figured that out yet?
We were looking at one company that was for sale, and they showed us their top 10 revenue producers, and the biggest one was a lady who had spent in the last year $125,000 for credits to play that she can't win anything. But here's an interesting, and people say, how could anybody, and I still don't know, because, by the way, that same lady could have logged down and played $125,000 for live.
Right.
Some of them are illegal sites, but they are.
Sure, right, yeah.
But if you really think of it logically, anybody who's a regular slot player for money can't win either.
Right.
They can have statistical deviation from the norm,
yeah,
but they can't win.
Yeah.
I was just telling a friend of mine today at breakfast, I have another friend here in Vegas who was bragging to me one time that he's had 40 royal flushes in his since he's been here, and I said, God, I'd sure like to have what you lost.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I mean, nobody who's gotten 40 royal flushes could ever be a winner.
No.
It would be impossible.
Right.
So, is there really that big a difference between playing for credits that you can't cash and playing for real money that you can't long-term win?
Right.
Maybe you don't want to put that in the article, but it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal how much money people spend. And they have such big databases because only 2% of the people pay.
Right.
Now, I have a friend in Turkey who plays poker on one of these sites.
Right.
But he wants to play in the big game, and I understand that.
Right.
So he puts in $100 every couple months, gets $40 million worth of credits, loses it, but I understand. I can't understand where it's more exciting to put $100 fake money into a slot machine as opposed to a penny, fake penny into a slot. But I'll tell you a story. Let's go back to the 1980s in Minneapolis. A friend of mine owned a bar, and every Friday night, he ran casino night. Basically social gaming.
Yeah.
Three blackjack tables, pretty girls. You could buy, a $10 pack, a $20 pack, or a $50 pack to go play. The only difference is these are $5 chips, these are 20, and these are 100.
Sure.
No value.
Right.
Really, exactly the model of social gaming.
Yeah.
Yet guys would buy the $100 pack
because
they wanted to bet the $100 with the girl next to them as opposed to the $5 one. I always got a kick out of that. And now I never even thought about it, but basically he was a forerunner of social gaming.
No question.
And maybe had he gotten into it, he would actually understand it today, the only because he was there back in the 80s doing it.
Right, right, okay. Well, as someone who broke his teeth on real live poker, what do you make of online poker where you play against people you can't see, you know?
Well, I enjoyed it very much until it became totally illegal. Now I don't play, although I think I ended up losing more than I won.
Right.
One of the problems with online gaming is cheating. And, you know, poker, unfortunately, the history of poker has been cheating a lot.
Right.
And nobody's made it easier than online poker. I've never known, seen it actually, but I know there were syndicates that literally sat in a room like this with 20 screens and 20 guys and a commander that's saying, And I always thought, and it didn't happen, I always thought online gaming would gravitate to heads up. Because heads up, there's no collusion.
Right.
But
it
did. There is some, of course.
Yeah.
But not as much prevalent as I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, number one, it is up to the states to legalize it or not, but they all got to go together.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there's just not a big enough population in the three states that have legalized it to make poker really a viable, you go online to WSOP here in town.
Right.
And there's very little action.
Right.
Little, but not much.
Not enough for, right. for serious poker.
But over games. Over time, it's going to become legal, unless the unless they federally ban all internet gaming. I personally would favor banning not poker on the internet, but I would favor all other. Mm-hmm. I consider internet, you know, slot gaming on the internet is the equivalent to a liquor company putting in faucets in your home, vodka,
right.
gin, bourbon. You know, you just turn the faucet and you get some. I think you should have to go out of your way a little bit to game, and therefore, I don't think it's really very good to just have tune on your slot machine and start playing.
Okay, I'll make sure Mr. Adelson listens to this podcast.
Well, yeah, that's true. But he's against poker too. I'm not
right,
against
he is,
poker.
Yes, no question. Well, Al, it's been really great talking to you. You know, we've followed your career through the years and always been impressed with what you're doing. And this Golden Entertainment venture, I think, is really going to take off. And hopefully we can talk again sometime soon after you get into your next project.
Sure. Maybe do a follow-up once we have the shareholder vote. So it's 100%, although we're 99% certain. But once we have our shareholder vote, I think our stock has reacted very favorably. We mm-hmm. like that. You know, I haven't had a single shareholder call me up and say, what the hell are you doing? This is nuts. And I've had some, quite frankly, very sophisticated investors call me up, funds. Mm-hmm. Lyle, you know, you did a good deal. You did a good, when I say deal, a good thing. That this is what we were hoping for
right.
in something like this.
Right.
So,
well, we're looking forward to seeing where it goes. And congratulations on that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us on the GGB Podcast. If you want to read more about this issue or any issue in the gaming industry, read our magazine, GGB Magazine, or visit ggbmagazine.com. For weekly updates on the gaming industry, subscribe to GGB News. For more information, visit ggbnews.com. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and we'll see you next week on the Global Gaming Business Podcast.